Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Joining us today to talk about the movement to unite artists and scientists is the Wexner Center for the Arts Director of Education, Shelley Casto. Shelley, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Ann. Thanks for having us.
Also with us in the studio, renowned scientist Lonnie Thompson. He is a professor of earth sciences and a research scientist with the Bird Polar Research Center at OSU. In particular, he is a glaciologist, and he's made 57 trips up there. Lonnie, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. And with us from Toronto for the moment is David Buckland. He's internationally renowned photographer, filmmaker, and designer, and creator of the Cape Farewell Project. It's a cultural organization that connects artists with scientists on trips to the Arctic. David, thanks for joining us.
Welcome. It's good to be with you.
David, do you do a lot of these sort of panels?
Quite a few. I mean, it surprised me. The K4World project started small and has now become quite a big international activity. And so, therefore, there's a lot of talking in panels, which is exciting. I like doing them a lot.
The movement, can I call it a movement? And was there an inception, or are we at a certain stage in it? How do you define it?
It was an inception. I am still an artist, but I'm also running this rather large international program now. But it started from artistic inquiry, and I was working with some mathematical modelers 10 years ago, and they were the ones who were first bringing these huge kind of mathematical models, climate models, into fruition. And they mathematically modeled the whole of the North Atlantic Ocean, and I thought that was an extraordinary and quite ridiculous thing to attempt to do and to achieve. So I was very, very curious, met them and talked with them, and it soon became apparent. I mean, this is 10 years ago, and, you know, climate change wasn't on anybody's kind of agenda, really, except for the science community. And they were, you know, they had the information in the way that we have now, and they were trying to find a way of getting it into the public. But they were using a language of graphs and data and, you know, and the public, you know, they can't listen to that kind of information. So the initial call was to try and find, okay, let's see if we not create a new language, we sort of create a new language, a sort of a different way of speaking about climate change that is not just done through data and scientific information. So that's how the K4World project was born. I took a group of 20 artists and scientists, and we embedded and we went up to the Arctic together on a beautiful sailing schooner. And the scientists carried on their, you know, their work, their progress of trying to understand what's happening to the oceans. And the artists were intrigued and absolutely fascinated by the way the scientists would approach something as complex and as big as this situation.
How do the two disciplines, if I can call them that, you know, intersect artistically? What struck you artistically about that work when you were meeting with the mathematicians?
I think one of the things when we first started is the scientists thought the artists would come and illustrate their data. And I think they soon realized that they were dealing with equal professionals, very, very lucid, very, very articulate. And what happened in a way was that the artists or the writers, the artists, the architects, would absorb all the information the scientists would give out, but then find a completely different way of telling the story. And I think that excited the scientific community a lot. And then it became a really exciting process of exchange.
You know, I was thinking what the scientists needed was just a really good PR agent. And I wonder why something like that wouldn't work and how the spark occurred with artists. But, you know, you sort of explained it, but still they have a PR problem.
I don't think it's a PR problem, actually, because what happens is, I mean, there's lots of times they've tried to use advertising to highlight climate change. And, you know, it's not like you're buying a product. You're actually buying something incredibly complex. And therefore, to get over the complexity of the idea and probably the seriousness of the idea, you do need to flesh it out and be much more kind of articulate with the information that's coming through to you. And I think, you know, if you just, with the PR agent, there is no simple spin on this. You need somebody, you know, that is going to really deal with it with a seriousness. And I think the other thing that artists do is that you know, if you read a great novel, I mean, Ian McEwan has just produced this new novel, Soda, which was all inspired by one of our expeditions. If you read that, you know, you kind of, the information goes inside you. You inhabit the information. You know, if you look at a great work of art, you don't sort of just sit there and analyze it and take out the kind of the cream that you just want. You actually inhabit the kind of piece of art. And I think what the artists have done is made these huge kind of global concepts of the scientists down to a human scale story. So they say, look, this is how I reacted, how I thought, how I could tell the story of being in the Arctic or being or addressing some of the science issues. So I think it's very different than just PR. It's something much grander. And I think the subject warrants it.
Yeah, when you put it in terms of telling a story, that is very different and in human terms. And there's nothing more personal than art.
Yeah, that's it. Exactly it. And I mean, what surprised me enormously is, A, the project's still going. You know, I started off with thinking, oh, we'll just do a couple of trips up to the Arctic, mm-hmm. and that would be it. But we've been up there, not 57 times, but we've been up there 9 times, which is pretty good, you know. We've had something like, I think, 70 artists have gone through the program, and the outcomes, we've produced two, well, we've got a new film coming up, so it's the second film we produced. You know, Ian McEwan's book, but there's been exhibitions, there's a worldwide exhibition touring. You know, the outcomes have been extraordinary and always have generated enormous public interest, partly because of the subject matter and partly because we've had great artists kind of telling the story.
How does it, well, before we go on, I just want to remind my listeners that we're talking about not just climate change, but the discussion about climate change and the experience that artists and scientists and activists are having together as they travel around the world, discovering what climate change means. Join on that panel is David Buckland and Lonnie Thompson. And Shelley Casto is also from the Wexner Center for the Arts. She's the director of education there. She is with us today as well. I wanted to talk about how does one get on one of these trips? What's the criteria?
The criteria shifts. Because obviously each trip we tend to try and make a film of it. So then a lot of the artists are on to kind of, so we focus it down to say one sort of look at subject matter.
Okay.
So in 08, we had brilliant musicians with us. This year we're going up to the Russian Arctic, and because we're dealing with the word, with notion of writers, playwrights. So we have those kind of focuses and shifts on each journey and each expedition. So that sort of dictates, well, okay, then you're looking, you know, who are the musicians you'd really like to work with? And they're not activists. These are not musicians who say, oh, mm-hmm. I only do climate change. Mm-hmm. These are really great, you know, Laurie Anderson, Leslie Feist, Martha Wainwright, Jarvis Cocker, you know, Richie Sakamoto. None of them you would say, oh, that's a climate mm-hmm. artist. These are just great musicians. And we bring, you know, so that was the gathering that we brought together for that one. And as I say, the Russian one this year is truly exciting, but fraught, as you can imagine, especially with the current news, fraught with complication. But there are some really interesting Russian playwrights and writers out there, and we'll be working with those and the international crew of having, you know, both U.S. and Canadians, Brits on board.
You said the outcomes have been extraordinary. It's no doubt. Can you tell us a little bit about the outcomes? You know, give us an idea, a sampling.
Yeah, I mean, well, we just did an exhibition. I curated an exhibition for the Royal Academy in London, and it opened in early December. And there, you know, we put out a call, and I think we had 32 different artists there, and each one told a different kind of story. So Sophie Cowell. Anthony Gormley did a beautiful field. And then, as I said, Ian McEwan, his new book, Solar, I think it's just about to be launched in the US. You know, it's about a physicist. I mean, the character is a physicist in the book. He's quite a failed character. I mean, he's a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, but actually not a very nice man. So this is the person that Ian has chosen to carry the mantle of the passage through modern climate thinking. So that was all inspired because Ian came up on one of our expeditions up into the Arctic. I was thinking music-wise, the film that we've just got coming out, which is called Burning Ice, You know, it's extraordinary when you get a musician like Katie Tunstall, and she is inspired to write a new song that is in some way deals with climate, but it's not just about climate. It's about the way we live, about our values, about, you know, all of the other things that, you know, are excesses, that maybe the excesses aren't necessary. So she, you know, she's questioning that in the song. So I think that's sort of where it comes, that it's not about the science. It's, you know, I keep sort of saying that, you know, scientists have done a brilliant job and continue to do a brilliant job in saying, look, there's quite a serious problem here. But in a way, the cause of climate change is, you know, the way we've evolved our kind of lifestyle, I suppose, over the last 200 years. And we have to question that, and we have to think about it, and we have to say, well, okay, let's embrace new technology rather than the carbon technology to produce the energy that we need. So it's a brave new world, and I think that brave new world has excited the artists to be excited, too, about the subject.
David, I understand that the artists aren't necessarily activists, but do you invite skeptics?
Do I invite skeptics? Mm-hmm. I thought they'd all gone.
Well, I've got
they're
a bridge to sell
you. Right. Can't find them anywhere.
I'm sure you don't attract them like moths.
No, people don't come on with an opinion. You know, that, okay. You know, they come on and say, hey, you know, they well, okay, I'll join this, and I don't know anything about the subject, or I'm not sure that this is, you know, this is real. So they're not, you know, they're not trained skeptics. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are people who are genuinely curious, as artists are, but they come on, quite often come on board with an open mind. And then you kind of debate both sides, and you look at all sides, and it's up to them. We never prescribe that they have to do something, you know, they have to take a position. And what always amazes me is that, you know, artists come, I mean, the writers, they come up with something I couldn't have imagined. And it doesn't always please me, you know. I kind of go, right, okay, fine, but you know, it's their perspective, it's their openness.
Okay, we're going to have to
jump in there for a minute, sure. If I could. Mm-hmm. Another thing that I
hi
David.
Hi, Sherry.
Another thing that I find with artists is I come from an art background, and I got into the arts because I'm really interested in generating conversations with people through looking at art, and that's another thing that artists are really good at is getting people to engage in conversations about issues, and that's sort of what you were saying, David, about inhabiting the work, really engaging with it, wrestling with it, talking about it, and so I think that's another contribution that artists make.
We're going to have to take a short break, and then we will return to our panel. In the studio with me, Shelley Casto. She is the Director of Education for the Wexner Center for the Arts, and also Lonnie Thompson, Professor of Earth Sciences and renowned glaciologist. He is in the studio as well. And then on the phone from Toronto is David Buckland. He is the founder of the Cape Farewell Project. He's also a renowned photographer, filmmaker, and designer. We'll be right back. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. In the meantime, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org for questions or comments. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Thursday night at 9 p.m. on WOSU-TV. Tune in for WOSU's special culinary event, Chefs in the City. Now in its fourth year, this year's Gourmet Food Experience features PBS celebrity master chef Rick Bayless and several other local chefs who share their cooking tips and tricks and prepare mouth-watering recipes. Watch Chefs in the City on WOSU-TV Thursday night at 9.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Get the latest information from the station the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. Just go to WOSU.org/email and sign up for one of our e-newsletters. 59 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:20 this morning. Sunshine today, a high of 68. A few clouds tonight, a low of 45. Morning sun for Friday. Clouds move in the afternoon, bringing a slight chance of rain and a high of 63 tomorrow. And then rain is likely over the weekend. Rain and clouds on both Saturday and Sunday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher, and the program continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about climate change in a little bit different way today. We're talking with scientist Lonnie Thompson. I'm sure you've heard of him before. He is the famed glaciologist. He's been up to the Arctic 57 times. In his work, he's at OSU through the Byrd Polar Research Center at OSU. And also David Buckland. He is the internationally renowned photographer, filmmaker, and designer, and founder and creator of the Cape Farewell Project. It's a cultural organization that connects artists with scientists on trips to the high Arctic. And also with us, Shelley Casto. She is director of education for the Wexner Center for the Arts. Let's take a quick call right now. Jerome, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. And you kind of asked the question I was going to ask.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. Okay. But what concerns me is when I was in school, the coming ice age was taught in science classes as dogma. And then the population explosion was taught in science classes dogma. And now my children are learning that man-caused climate change is dogma. There is no debate about it. The teachers teach it not as science, but as dogma. And what concerns me is that when OSU has a project like this, the OSU imprature alone stifles debate rather than fostering debate.
How so does it stifle?
Because, I mean, David himself said he couldn't get skeptics.
No, he didn't say that. No. He didn't say that.
Even the term skeptic labels people who are in opposition to it, and is a disparaging term. And I'm saying when OSU and many of the teachers are educated at OSU, and the whole Central Ohio community looks to OSU, and when projects like this, and I'm not saying I'm a skeptic or I'm in agreement with it. I'm just concerned mm-hmm. about what happens in the classroom when such events like this exhibition have, are so widely known. It just reinforces this idea that there is no debate.
Well,
and I just wanted to point out that Brave New World would have been is not the appropriate term to employ. I mean, considering what Aldous Huxley was trying to argue against.
Okay. Number one, I used the word skeptics. David didn't.
Okay.
Number two, I think David did say that they don't ask people in advance. They don't screen them for or against.
But he said they don't exist.
No, he did not.
Jerome,
he was joking. He was being facetious. So was I. We were joking.
Okay.
Okay. Right, David? I'm taking liberties, or is that right, David? We were just joking.
Jerome, I mean, there's a really strong debate going on, both within the science community and in the media about, the whole issue of climate change. And it is so complicated that there is, this is why we welcome, every time we go up, we embed ourselves with the scientists. Because, if you've ever been to a scientific debate about climate change that's in closed doors, you will see furious argument where they question each other, they question each other's information, and they go backwards and forwards. So I think that the whole debate is actually that. It's the strongest debate I've ever come across. And I'm not taking, I know a lot of information that I'm responding to. But I think you should go over to Lonnie on this one. Lonnie, this is the usual answer.
Well, Lonnie's right here. Hang on, Jerome.
Yes, I would say that the scientists are skeptics. I mean, that's our nature. We question everything that we do. So I think that you might better term on this climate issue, they're deniers of climate change. But skeptics, and the best we can do for what we present in our high schools is looking at peer-reviewed information. And I think as long as the information that's being presented has some quality control in it, then it has a place in classrooms and in any type of event.
I can assure you that some science teachers in the public schools, I've argued with several of them about it, they say quite openly it is their mission to, through the children, convince the parents that man-made climate change is real and they need to take all sorts of actions. And I'm saying, where's the debate in your classroom? Okay. Where's the counter evidence? And they said, there is none. Hmm. So it's And I don't think this is just a few cases.
Okay, you know what, Jerome? So, Jerome, I certainly don't want to cut you off. No one, absolutely, there is a huge debate about climate change. That's why we're talking about this and talking about this intersection of art and science and talking about climate change. Climate change might not be the only issue that folks talk about when scientists and artists get together. It's just one of possibly many. So, did you get to see what I mean, Jerome?
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
oh,
so
yeah.
Well, I don't want to turn the program into a debate about climate change per se, but rather that intersection of art and science. So, okay?
Okay.
All right.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Just a quick follow-up on that, and I think one of the benefits of this whole debate is that the scientific community and the artistic community have been brought much closer together. Traditionally, in the 1800s, they were always embedded with each other's inquiry, and specialization has meant that we've drifted apart. But I do think it is one of the healthiest things that has come out of this.
Well, I wanted to bring that up, David, because I read somewhere, when I was preparing for this, that you were in an interview, you were sort of celebrating that experience of seeing the creative meeting of the scientific and artistic minds, and you sort of wondered why these two communities moved apart. And I wanted to talk about that a little bit. And Lonnie.
Yes, I think that by and large, people are visual. And I think whether you're an artist or a scientist, you try to visualize the world. And it's amazing that if you look at what we know about climate back through time, that art has always played an important role. Even if you go back 5,000 years ago in the Sahara Desert, we have records of paintings in caves that show animals that lived in this part of the world when there was water there. And we would not know about that if those paintings weren't there. And I teach a paleoclimate class, and I use as one of our evidence of change some work by Neuberger that was published back in 1970, where he looked at 12,000 paintings from the period from 1400 up to 1967. But what he looked at was how clear the sky was, how blue it was, how many clouds there were. He made a statistical compilation of that. And in that, you can actually see the Little Ice Age, a climate period when glaciers advanced in Europe, more clouds, darker settings. So artists record their environment, nature, just like scientists do. And I also believe that it's all about creativity. It's all about getting the message out to people. Well, I mean, we can publish our papers in Science and Nature, but very few people will read those. So we need ways in which we communicate with the larger public, and I think art is very important in that.
Now, Lonnie, on your excursions, you said you also travel with artists and film producers and that sort of thing.
Yeah, we're scientists. We take artists with us.
Have artists will travel, right?
Yeah, we take writers and photographers because I think it is the visual. Even in our discipline, if we publish a paper in science, we will have twice the readership if we get a cover, a photograph on that journal. People are attracted. They marvel at things in nature. And I think so it's a very important part of communicating the science visually to people. We take in our last expedition, we had BBC, National Geographic. We had a company from Argentina producing films, and those films reach millions of people, whereas our science and nature papers reach our science community, but not the people that ultimately can make a difference.
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Science and art, and art, where does it intersect for you? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. I was wondering, Lonnie, if working with artists has changed how you do your work, how you think about your work.
I think, the visual, how you take something that's very complex, what David was talking about, and put it into a form that you can link to people. And I believe the area in which we work, where we deal with glaciers and ice, glaciers aren't political. They have no political agenda. They just respond to their environment. If you have an artist along who can document that and show that, then you can reach millions of people. If on this issue of climate change, if you live in a place where there is ice, be it the Arctic Ocean or glaciers, you have no doubt that the climate is changing. You can question, what the drivers are of that change and things like that. But you know that it's changing. But if you're living here in central Ohio where you cannot see those changes, then it becomes more abstract. And I think artists can bring that back into the homes of people who live in areas where there are no glaciers.
David, was that the way it was for you before you went to the Arctic? It was abstract. You really didn't know.
Yeah, I went up with an open mind as well, and it is quite extraordinary that if we're in a sailboat and we're sailing along these coasts, and you have these nautical charts, and the charts say, this glacier comes down here between two headlands, and there wouldn't be any glacier there, that it had gone, and you kind of go, wait a minute, and that happened repeatedly, so that these kind of marine, or the glaciers that end up right into the sea, right into the coast, are receding. Quite extraordinary. And, it does change the information on the nautical charts that you've got that probably are only 20, 25 years old. So the changes there are really quite quick. And I think that's just a physical thing that you observe. But then, thankfully, we were with the science, the science stations where the scientists have been sitting up there all winter and working with the data. And then, you just learn and how it works.
Lonnie, the debate seems to be where there is a debate about the climate change, and there certainly is, about what's causing it, not so much that the glaciers are melting. No one denies that.
Yep. Yes. Yeah. And they're all kind of evidence we use to look at those changes in the drivers. And we have records now of the output of the sun from our satellites for over 40 years, and we know that hasn't increased. We know the temperatures are warming more at night and during the winter than during the day and during the summer, so we know it's not the sun that's driving it. And so the only way that we can, as scientists, account for what we're seeing is to add the greenhouse gases. If there was another mechanism out there, and we have thousands of scientists who are looking for what those drivers are, then we could point to something else. But right now, our best knowledge points to the human impact on our climate system.
And because of that, I think there's a real there's real agreement about the fact that we don't have a lot of time to make change, and that part of what I'm interested in is getting people engaged in the issues and then finding their own role in terms of making that change. We really don't have time to wait too long to take action. And so I'm particularly interested in young people. I'm interested in the university students who will come to the program tonight and see models in Professor Thompson and in the artists who are involved who have taken it upon themselves as their mission to wrestle with these issues and then to make some substantial progress on them.
And that's kind of the general philosophy behind the Wexner Center's Director's Dialogue on Art and Social Change. Mm-hmm. How big is that, prevalent is that kind of approach to art and science now?
That approach in terms of
in other institutions around the country.
Sure. I think a lot of institutions around the country are looking to artists and other cultural creators to talk about social issues. That is what artists do in large part. And we want to present a regular platform for that to happen here in Columbus.
You started a program targeted to teenagers. It's called Art and Environment. Is that part of it as well?
Absolutely. I started that program 6 years ago when I noticed that there were a lot of artists who were dealing with environmental issues, and I felt that was a topic that would really engage young people, really inspire their imagination. And I knew I had the opportunity to introduce them in person to artists and scientists being here on a major research university campus, artists being an international arts institution. I knew I could invite artists in to talk with, such as David Bocklin, to talk with my students, and give them a model of someone who's chosen a career that is not live by the book, follow the training model, training manual, punch in and punch out, have someone else tell you how to live your life, but rather find your own path, follow your own interests, make work on your own.
That makes sense to
yeah,
you.
As scientists do and artists do.
A few years ago, you had an artist in, and I really enjoyed it. She was drawing the line around New York City to show where the water level would be.
Eve
in
Mosher.
A few,
yeah. She's terrific. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about what she did.
Yeah, Eve Mosher is an artist from New York who decided that she would make visible to neighborhood residents in New York City and surrounding boroughs of how far the sea would actually rise within a certain set period of time. If we did not reverse global climate change. So she took a rolling chalk marker and literally went through the streets of New York and drew this line, and people could see where they in the water or were they outside the water? Was there did their house make it or did it not? And so, you know, in a very tangible, visible way, she's making the effects clear to people. She is great.
David?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think this is, you know, this is an inquiry that a lot of artists are being very excited by. But what it's moving from is, you know, one of the things about climate change is it's always like it's what you can't do. It's always reductive. You know, you can't do this. You won't be able to do this. You won't be able to do this. What I think is happening now is that there are so many new technologies around for producing energy. Taking solar and then sort of releasing, you know, almost down to an atomic level, what happens to electrons as they spin off? Can you harness that energy? And these solutions are so exciting, and I think there's a lot of artists getting very involved with the solutions of where we can go, rather than just say, wait a minute, climate change is, you know, our society won't be able to do these things. And I think that's a shift that's probably happening more and more, and is getting, you know, more and more exciting, that we're looking to the future and kind of going, wow, you know, the society, not only the society could be different, but the way it's energized, the way we draw down on energy, and the way we make, you know, use of new transport systems and things like that. And I think artists are embracing that and telling that story as well.
We're going to have to take another short break. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
You can always count on comic and actress Sarah Silverman to talk about things that make people uncomfortable or that make her uncomfortable. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with her about her new memoir, The Bedwetter, Stories of Courage, Redemption, and Pee. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Beginning May 7th, see a new lineup of public affairs programming on Friday nights on WOSU TV. Starting at 8 is Washington Week, followed by Columbus on the Record at 8:30. Continuing at 9 is McLaughlin Group, and at 9:30, PBS presents Need to Know, a new program with an innovative broadcast and web approach to news gathering and reporting. Watch the new public affairs lineup beginning May 7th on WOSU TV. And 59 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:40. Sunshine today, a high near 68. A few clouds tonight, a low of 45. Sunshine Friday morning and then clouds in the afternoon, bringing a slight chance of rain, a high of 63. And unfortunately, it looks like a rainy, cloudy weekend. Rain in the forecast for Saturday and Sunday. Be a part of the studio audience with WOSU's Ann Fisher tonight at 6. Join Ann and her guests at WOSU at COSI to share your thoughts and feelings about pressing issues facing Columbus's Short North. You can attend and be a part of the radio and TV audience. Visit WOSU.org for more information, and we hope to see you at COSI tonight at 6. And All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Tech Columbus, presenting the 2010 Innovation Summit on May 27th. Executives and industry thought leaders will explore new thinking about innovation and leadership. More at TechColumbusInnovationSummit.com.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about the intersection of science and art, in this case, as it affects the discussion on climate change. 614-292-8513. And Bob, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. You know, I worked on climate change beginning in the late 70s, so it's been an uphill battle, so to speak. But I'm curious what your people there think about anti-intellectualism and anti-art sorts of people, and how the public institutions have supported being not intellectual.
Wait, you're saying that you want to ask how anti-intellectualism and anti-art has affected this discussion, and you're saying the public institutions have supported the anti-intellectualism?
I think so. Forgive those who I will offend by mentioning President Bush, but he never struck me as his heaviest hitter in
those kind of institutions. Okay, I see what you mean.
And so what I'm asking is that in the context of anti-intellectualism, whether the overwhelming data tell people that are on the denier's side the same message that they seem to tell scientists and policy people like me.
Thanks, Bob. That's a good question. I mean, we're not all looking at the same art. We're not all watching the same shows. Lonnie and I were talking earlier about half the meteorologists in the country, television meteorologists that are surveyed, are skeptical
mm-hmm.
about it. Lonnie?
Well, I think, first of all, I mean, you talk about meteorologists. They deal with weather, the variability in the climate system. And when we talk about climate science, we're actually talking about a 30-year average of that weather and what those trends are. And people don't see trends so well as because they're slow. They come in increments year after year. And our normalcy is usually based on our experience. It's only when we have a perspective, and whether that perspective comes from the science, from histories that we have written on the earth, or it comes from art, do we see or can evaluate change that is taking place. So I think it's I think we have to look at on any issue, especially in a democracy, that people fall into kind of a normal distribution. There are extremes on both ends, but they're about 80% in the middle when they're given the evidence, the facts coming from all different sources. They will make the right choices for the future.
And I think from my perspective, you know, presenting a range of perspectives is absolutely what the Wexner Center is about and what the university is about, and giving people direct access to scientists and to artists who are really at the top of their game is what we should be doing, and then letting people make their own decision about it.
Mm-hmm. Bob, does that help?
Yeah. Yes, I'm curious what they would say about people who call what they teach creation science, then.
You want to know what they think about people who teach creation science?
Who call it creation science.
I'm not sure I understand the question, Bob. Sorry.
Right, what I'm trying to get at is if you call something science, that doesn't make it science. It has to be falsifiable, has to be... you can never prove science true, all the philosophy of science criteria, and it has to make certain predictions. And as far as I'm concerned, transformations still follow from one paradigm to another through sociological change, like Kuhn wrote about.
Okay. All right. Well, Bob, thanks for your call.
Sure. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
David.
Yes.
Yeah, David, could you tell us like what a typical trip would be like? What do you do? How long do they last? And really, what goes on?
Yeah. There are two. Well, first of all, the one that's just coming up, say the Russian one. We're going to the Franz Josef Islands, which are probably within about 600 miles of the North Pole. Normally very ice bound, but in the last few years, they're not totally navigable. So that's where we're visiting. What is great is because they're inside Russian waters, they're incredibly pristine. They're not affected. So things like the wildlife are not affected by tourism or any kind of intervention from outside. And also it's the top end of the Gulf Stream or the Norwegian Current, one of the branches that goes up, and that's one of the things we'll be measuring. So there's a very detailed science program. We have four scientists, one Russian on board, two physical oceanographers, and then a marine biologist, and then somebody who's very interested in the animals and the wildlife. So those are people on board. We set sail. These sea passages are long, and it'll take us 5 days to get there from Spitsbergen. But we convert this sailing vessel into a research vessel, and that's allowed, we can do it with modern technology. The instrumentation of the science is much, much smaller, so we can handle it. And we actually get, we get real data as a scientist would add, and that data fits in. We probably launch an Argo float. So that process, the program of the science, will dictate the journey. But then, the artists on board, the writers, will say, well, actually, can we do this? Can we be ashore here? Can we spend time observing this? Can we do this? Can we do that? And that will then feed into the program, and that's how it will evolve. This one is 20 days, which is a very long time. It's not a long time for a science research program. But, you're taking really incredibly busy professionals and saying, can you give up 20 days of your time in order to do this expedition? So that's a big ask. Other ones have been much shorter. When we had all the musicians on board because of their schedules, I think we did an expedition of 10 days. So, they vary depending on. And we've also, we have looked at the Arctic, most of the time, but we did an expedition last year in the Andes, which was going down through the cloud forests to the headwaters of the Amazon, and that was by walking. So that was another inquiry based with scientists from the ECI in Oxford in England who had science stations, and we walked from science station to science station. And again, following the science, but finding ways of interpreting and inspiring.
Lonnie, when you do your trips, they vary in length a great deal?
They vary in length, and they're generally of the order of 1 to 2 months. We actually had expeditions to Franz Josef Land in 1994 and did a drilling project there in 1997. And we've been working now in Peru for over 33 years because in Peru you have 70% of the world's tropical glaciers. And the people there are already being impacted in their water supplies by the loss of those glaciers. So these are exciting places, and I truly believe that when you take scientists or artists into these places and they see for themselves, it's something about human nature. If you can see it, then you believe it. And it's a much straighter way to reach people than, say, talking about oxygen isotopes or stable isotopes in an ice core record. So I think this is where this linkage between the science and the art is so important.
Yeah, and we were talking earlier, too, that, when it comes to ideas, a scientist and an artist, the ideas aren't, you don't punch in a clock and say, okay, now I'm going to be a scientist today, and this is, I'm on the clock now, and I'm going to make up something amazing. Or an artist does, neither does an artist, David, right? You can't time that sort of thing. And I was thinking, when you go on a 10 or 20-day trip, how often the artists are inspired after the fact sometimes, where it's like a delayed reaction.
That is usually the case. You're just bombarded with so much visual information, which, because one of the things you you soon learn that the Arctic is the most beautiful place on the planet. It's really quite extraordinary.
I think you've said it's sort of addicting.
Oh, it's very addictive. The first thing you want to do when you come back is to go up there again. And I think I understand Lonnie's sitting there 15-7 times. I mean, that's a really bad addiction you've got.
Yes, it is. It's really bad.
The monkey is on his back.
That's the excitement. But, you know, Ian McEwan's book, Ian was deeply affected by the expedition, and for 2 years afterwards said, David, I can't find a way of making this into a novelistic form. You know, I can't find a way of telling a story that actually deals with this enormous subject. And then famously he kind of announced it about 2 years ago. I found a way of creating this Nobel character, the Nobel scientist character. And great, you know, but that process has taken 5 years after the fact of his expedition. He was up in 2005. It's now 2010, and the book is launched. That process is quite often for the science, for the artist, and I think it's the same, you know, with the scientist. You know, the field trips, the way you gather the data, it's the inquiry. It's that you kind of get all this information back, and then you bring all the information home. And it takes years of really understanding it and analyzing it and drawing in from other people who've done very similar things before you actually see or create the patterns or can actually state any of the kind of scientific facts that you need to state. So, you know, the process is always long. But I go back to Shelley's point is that, you know, wait a minute, we now know this is probably a very, very urgent issue. And the window of opportunity, you know, whatever we do, say if we all, you know, decarbonized our activity today, it would take 20 years probably for the real effects to be seen. So, you know, there is this time delay. So, you know, we do have to start engaging and being excited by a different kind of future, and we have to start doing that fairly quickly. And I think now we there's enough information there. And there's enough other reasons to actually look at and say, well, let's really question this, reconstruct, embrace new technology, get going forward on this.
Nani, is that how it works for you?
It does. And to me, when we talk about the climate change issue, you can totally look at this in a different way. We live in a country where we import over 70% of our oil from foreign sources. We have a workforce. 88% of that workforce commutes to jobs every day. We have a country that is at risk because of our dependence on these fossil fuels. The solution to this dependency is alternative energy. And we need to go down that route for issues of national security as well as for issues of climate change. So to me, this is a win-win. It's really a no-brainer. It is a road that we have to go down, and the sooner we get started down that road, the sooner we will make an impact on our carbon emissions.
You know, Shelley, when Jerome called earlier, he mentioned that the teachers were very upfront about saying that we're going to teach your kids something so that they bring it home and then they teach their parents and get to their parents through the kids. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're trying to do when you're working with the high school students?
Well, the course that I'm teaching, we are all starting from a basic understanding that the science does show that it's quite likely that global climate change is caused by human interference. So why not start from that perspective and teach students to change their lifestyle, be less consumeristic, more in touch with nature, more do-it-yourself in their approach to things. I do think that that science is being taught in the schools. That's a science teacher's job, is to teach the science. So I'm glad to hear that that's happening from his perspective. I do think that there's lots of – it's important to look at lots of different sides of an issue. And again, you know, there's not – when I'm introducing them to artists, I'm not – introducing them to one type of person. They're, you know, artists have so many different perspectives and outlooks on the world. So, but what I am trying to do is I find with teenagers there is a lot of hopelessness. There's a lot of feelings.
I wondered about
of
what their stories are like.
No, definitely. Young people feel powerless. They feel concerned about this, justifiably, because adults, you know, the current adults may not be around when the real problems hit. The young people will be. So they need to be concerned, but they need to not feel completely powerless. So I am trying to inspire them to find their passion, find what they're most interested in, follow that, and make something of it. Feel that they have the power to follow their interests to a constructive endpoint. I'll tell you a story.
Yes,
I have
please.
A student from the first year of the course, actually. His name is Samuel Newman, and he came to the course knowing that he wanted to do something in his career that mixed art and science, but was getting didn't get the information from his guidance counselors or his parents about what he could be. They were suggesting landscape architecture or medical illustration or things like that. That didn't quite fit his perspective on what he wanted to do. So he came to the course very interested in this idea of mixing art and science and hoping that he would come out of that with a career idea. He met Alexis Rockman, who is an artist who will be coming tomorrow night for the panel, who knows a lot about science, who collaborates with science, and really uses that science within the work that he creates. He's a painter. And that moment of meeting Alexis, for him, he realized that he could actually be an artist. And follow his scientific interests and make a difference in terms of communicating with people. So he has gotten his BFA from Alfred University for his final fine arts installation at Alfred. He created an installation about how to make your own wind turbine. So he had completely used what he had learned in the course in his sort of career direction, and he's looking to follow that. So,
David, a component of what you're doing, you are bringing students along too now, right? Or you have
we started off with a student program, mainly because, again, you know, the climate science wasn't being taught in the schools 10, 15 mm-hmm. years ago. So we started off creating modules that, you know, teachers could download, lesson plans, again, following glaciology, other parts of the science, oceanography. So that was an incredibly important part to us. And twice we've run expeditions up to the Arctic where actually the whole ship's been, with professional guidance, but the ship's been basically manned by 16, 17-year-olds, 18-year-olds who have, under the guidance, again, of onboard scientists, but they've conducted the experiment.
David,
and it's just fantastic to watch their energy and their excitement to actually understand how the data that they've been looking at is actually achieved or, you know, retrieved from the place that they're looking in.
David Buckland, artist and founder of the Cape Farewell Project, thanks for joining us today.
Absolute pleasure.
Also, Lonnie Thompson, distinguished university professor at the School of Earth Sciences at The Ohio State University. Glad to have you with us today.
Thank you very much.
And Shelley Casto at the Wexner Center. Thanks for being here. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.